Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Search for Captain Slocum, by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on the 21st chapter, and this is the 16th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out The Mariner Podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, The Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. 21. Dangers there are, to be sure, but the intelligence and skill God gives to a man reduce these to a minimum. The tragedy which overtakes some adventurers once they get to the top of the adventure is that they cannot really come down. Ordinary living is no longer possible. They are doomed to go on adventuring. Slocum was adrift. He wandered in and out of his friends' and neighbours' lives. Each saw him in his own way and remembered him as he saw him. A relative in Boston recalled that one day the captain popped in, unannounced, by way of the kitchen, she wrote, with an enormous cod tucked under his wing with just a paper round its middle, but the tail sticking out and part of the other end where the head was happily off. Slocum had been up and down the waterfront, seeking out old acquaintances, and one of the fishermen had given him the specimen of his favourite food. While constantly holding himself in check, the captain's warmer side found some outlet in witticisms, occasionally sentimentality and spells of sociability. He told Clifton Johnson that when visiting his friends, he was often asked to make a chowder, and when I do get up one of my proper old-fashioned codfish chowders, it brings them right to their feet, he said. Why, they were invalids before, he said. His method was so simple and gave such appetizing results. Put some pork and a sliced lemon in the pot and let that cook a while, he explained to his admirer. Then put in a layer of potatoes and next a layer of fish and so on up to the top with a seasoning of salt and pepper. Then add enough water to barely cover it and cook for 20 minutes. When it is about done, put in milk and bits of crackers or bread and let it simmer a while. Your codfish must be cut in chunks and you must have the skin on it and the bones in it. After 1904, Slocum spent little time on the farm or the vineyard. George G. Gifford, storekeeper and town clerk of West Tisbury for many years, recalled the captain as not extremely tall nor extremely short, but a quite pleasant chap who talked with everybody. It was the general opinion, the storekeeper said, that Slocum and his wife had separated. Nothing legal, but just that he went his way and she went hers. Another neighbour, Horace Athern, called Slocum well-spoken and courteous. He described him as a broad but lean and high-shouldered man who wore a close-cropped beard and was a great walker. According to Athern, the peripatetic captain explored the whole island. Still another vineyarder, S.C. Luce Jr., recalled the captain as slow-moving and slow-talking. But, he said, Slocum's head worked all right. Donald Campbell had a contrary impression. He thought Slocum's mind had been affected by the loss of the Aquidneck. Another resident of the village recalled the captain as eccentric. Joseph Chase Allen said that he knew Slocum the way a boy knows a man, that during the years Slocum was at the vineyard, he, Allen, lived in Chilmark with his uncle, Fred Mayhew, who drove the stagecoach. "I remember driving with him one evening to meet the boat," Allen said. The stage was just like a box and not too well made, all windows and doors. For the return trip, a rather well-dressed woman took the middle seat and then a man got aboard and took the seat clear aft in the dog-on box. I was up on the front seat with my uncle. We were headed up island in the usual way when all of a sudden I heard a hell of a rustle of paper. The man leans forward and says to the woman, "I hope you don't object to the smell of salt codfish." I looked around and he had the biggest jackknife I ever saw in my life, and he was hewing chunks off the fish and eating, and he ate a good deal of the way to West Tisbury. That was Slocum in 1904. He looked a lot like other men of his generation who had been to sea, whiskery, very quick in his movements, and inclined to be snappy in his speech as men will be who are accustomed to giving orders. He was not the kind of man who one would be tempted to take liberties with. Only the women didn't think too highly of a man who stayed away from home so much without any particular objective. Alan was also able to recall the spray tied up at Menashma Creek, 7 miles up island from West Tisbury. He said that the captain carried a small round-bottomed boat in the alleyway, chock full of all kinds of junk, and alongside the companionway, a Chinese gong and beside it, a wooden hammer hanging from a silk rope. Alan said the captain's topping lift was a very white native grass rope, and that a coil of the same kind of rope lay on one of the houses. Actually, on the vineyard, Slocum's brother Ornan was the better known of the two. Having forsworn the sea and being naturally closer to the run of mankind, Ornan had the time and inclination for the gregarious life. He lived to a very old age and liked to tell stories about his brother. It seems that one day he and Slocum went sailing in the spray out of Vineyard Haven. The captain set the course too close to the rocks around West Chop. Ornan, who was at the wheel, warned that they were in danger, but his brother was calling the orders. When finally Slocum realised that he really was in too close, he shouted in a voice like the last trumpet, "Hard over!" Ornan responded with such sudden and vigorous action that the captain fell full length on the deck, flat on his back. That was too much to take from Ornan. The captain sprang to his feet and made for him, but Ornan stood his ground. "Now wait, Josh. You gave the order, and I obeyed," he said. Slocum admitted it. Then Ornan, so the story goes, pressing his luck, added, "Josh, I'm a happy man this day. All my life I've wanted to land you on your back, and now, by gum, I've done it." In his brief career as farmer, the captain could not have made any money. It is much more likely that he lost. In the summer of 1905, Hetty began to take paying guests, while the captain lived a more private life in the sloop off the coast of Maine. At the end of August 1905, Slocum was reported back home after 6 months' leave. On the 21st of September, the Vineyard Gazette said, "Captain Joshua Slocum, accompanied by Mrs. Slocum, has been out on a fishing expedition in the sloop Spray." Apparently, Hetty was trying once more to become a seagoing wife, the captain to become a fisherman. But the life was wrong for Hetty, and Slocum was wrong for fishing. There was something about him that could not fish. Either he did not know how, or he anchored where there were none. A week later, when he turned up in Newport, Hetty had been replaced by a cat. "There is nothing fancy about this animal," a newsman reported. "No pedigreed feline, just plain cat. But it makes a good companion. His, Slocum's, boat is his house, and he spends most of his time in her." After renewing his license as a master mariner, the captain told the inquiring reporter that he was bound west to pick up his wife for a winter in southern waters. However, so far as Hetty was concerned, the plan to go south on the Spray fell through. In October, she and the captain made separate trips to Boston, which resulted in their making separate arrangements. The next month, the West Tisbury correspondent announced, "Mrs. Joshua Slocum has gone to Boston and expects to remain there most of the winter." The captain had already left home and gone to Menashma Creek, where the Spray, reliable as always, awaited. Past 60 now, but obsessed as ever, he was still making plans. Only first, he had an old piece of business to attend to. For 16 years, the Liberdade had been gathering dust in Washington, in the Smithsonian, and as the institution's collections had been growing rapidly, the 35-foot canoe was very much in the way. As far back as 1900, Slocum had written the curator that he was coming to fetch it, that he wanted to take it as well as the Spray to the Pan American Exposition. 5 years later, in June 1905, he wrote again, "The Liberdade, as a boat, has gone. If the old thing might be all sawed apart and bundled in some corner, I would gladly send the amount of the cost, and as soon as possible get the bundles away. If not, let the executioner do his work. I think you have been exceedingly patient and have been a friend." Now winter was coming. The captain was getting ready to sail, and the matter of the Liberdade was not settled yet. Though a few months before he was ready to take it apart, he now was anxious to keep it intact. He had arranged a deal. He would trade it, as was, to Henry B. Davis, the last inhabitant of No Man's Land, in exchange for a share in the harbour which Davis was going to build at Southeast Bend. No Man's Land, 1 mile long and 1.5 wide, lies off the southwest corner of Martha's Vineyard, an island outpost of an island. Davis was looking for a packet to run between No Man's and New Bedford, and thought the improvised boat, which once had come all the way from Brazil, might do. Slocum was looking for a trade, of course, but probably also for a home port for the sloop, and a port in a storm for himself. But the deal fell through. The harbour Davis planned was never dredged, the Liberdade never delivered, and No Man's Land no longer inhabited, today is a practice target for Navy bombers. One of Slocum's friends at Menashma was a man named Ernest J. Dean. Dean was a young trap fisherman, and having a boat with power, he also boated fish to New Bedford. He said that Slocum depended on him to tow the spray in and out of Menashma Creek, a worse tide hole then than now. He said that he and the aging captain, whom he greatly admired, spent hours together on the spray, or on Dean's boat, or in Dean's boathouse. The merchant captain, who had sailed all seas, discussed with his insular friend the forthcoming voyage. It was most interesting and educational, Dean wrote, to lay out the proposed courses with him, and also amusing to see him run his index finger, I think every finger and thumb on both hands was knuckle-busted, set back or crooked, they looked worse than the fingers of an old-time ball player, over miles and miles of ocean chart, and listened to his running chatter of his experiences in different parts shown on the chart. Sometime in November 1905, Slocum sailed from Menashma, bound for the West Indies, alone in the spray. Dean said the captain started in a hard norther, so as to get out into the Atlantic trade winds as soon as possible. Slocum sailed south by easy stages and called at Cuban and Jamaican ports. In Kingston, he was entertained by the colonel of the Royal Artillery, in the style he was accustomed to when going around the world. From there he sailed to Cayman Brac, and then to Grand Cayman. At Grand Cayman, he lived 2 months on the sloop. He called the country delightful, and winter there very pleasant. The sloop lay behind the reefs, where Slocum spent his time in fishing up conch shells. The natives dived for them in 2 fathoms of water, bringing up one at a time, but the Yankee skipper showed them a thing or two. He remembered the Vineyard quahog rake, and with some stiff wire which he had on board, he made himself something like it. With that device, he was able to scoop up a dozen at once. By the time he was ready to return to Massachusetts, the captain had shipped about 1,000 shells, together with such curiosities as specimens of the lace tree. Then, just before he sailed in early spring, several local admirers of Theodore Roosevelt asked him to deliver 6 rare orchid plants to the president. Slocum agreed to do so. Chapter 22. I was destined to sail once more into the depths of solitude, but these experiences had no bad effect upon me. On the contrary, a spirit of charity and even benevolence grew stronger in my nature through the meditations of these supreme hours on the sea. Solitude has its charms, but God did not think it good that man should be alone. Indeed, the lives of lonely men are beset with peculiar perils. According to what was reported in New Bedford, Slocum left Grand Cayman about the 1st of April, stopping at Key West and Beaufort, North Carolina, and reached New York near the end of July. That account, however, given out by Slocum himself, was highly compressed, even when allowances made for the patches of frustration and boredom and hardship which inevitably accompany a voyager. The captain was being reticent again. Following the habit of many years, he suppressed all references to difficulties, interior as well as outward, and to the extent that he did so, he held back reality as well. Among his Vineyard acquaintances was Leslie W. Miller, who, with his family, wintered in Philadelphia. Slocum may have had in mind a call on the Millers when, homeward bound, he detoured up the Delaware River and tied up at the Riverton, New Jersey Yacht Club, where he had been invited to lecture. At that point, the river is imposingly broad, and in those days some fine dwellings stood there. It is not far above Camden and opposite northeast Philadelphia. Percy Chase Miller, the son as well as his father, regarded Slocum as an upstanding, rather strong character, wearing what seemed, even then, old-fashioned chin whiskers. Anyone brought into contact with the old man would have been interested in his general nautical appearance and atmosphere. There was no mistaking he was an old sea dog, Percy Miller said. I also saw him near Camden sometime in 1906, after he got into trouble there. I felt he was a little dippy. He was put in jail and my father went to try and help him. About the same time, he spent a night with us. He arrived respectably and even nattily arrayed. I remembered him saying he'd like me to play the piano for him, and I did for an hour or more. He seemed to enjoy it, and the sounds were not unpleasing. Slocum was lean and hungry-looking and gaunt, but he looked as though he could take care of himself. I never was disappointed in his appearance or behaviour, though I am quite sure he was a little cracked. The trouble Miller referred to was published in a number of papers, including the Boston Herald, but not, apparently, in the Vineyard Gazette. The captain was charged with attempting to violate a 12-year-old girl on board the sloop. His Boston relations and his wife's read of the allegations, and in a cousin's words, the matter was so awful and our family so shocked that they soft-pedaled whenever we younger ones were around. We who knew the captain had found him affectionate to a degree with young things. At the scene, the local paper, a weekly, reported, held on serious charge. Naming the daughter of residents of the town, it said she had suffered indignities at the hands of Captain Slocum aboard his yacht, Spray, on the previous Friday. From the story of the child and an investigation by Dr. Mills, it became evident that the worst fears of the parents were not realised. The child not being injured, though she suffered considerably from nervousness. The incident is said to have occurred about 3 PM, while at 5, the paper reported, Slocum went off to Philadelphia. Was it then that he saw the Millers? If so, while the piano was playing, a warrant was being issued. The captain returned about 9 o'clock in the evening and was arrested by Marshal Quigley. He was given a hearing before Recorder Coddington Saturday morning and committed to the county jail without bail. At the hearing, Captain Slocum said he had no recollection of the misdemeanour with which he was charged, and if it occurred, it must have been during one of the mental lapses to which he was subject. The sloop Spray was placed in charge of Michael Faunce, pending other arrangements. Yesterday, Judge Gaskill set Captain Slocum's bail at $1,000. That headline reads that bail was set 6 days after the captain's arrest. The paper also published a letter written by the father of the girl, wherein he said that an article going the rounds and entitled An Assault on a Little Girl in Riverton, New Jersey, appeared to misstate the facts, and that he and his wife are greatly relieved to learn by questioning the child, also by Dr. C.S. Mills's examination, that there was no attempt at rape, for the child is not physically injured, although greatly agitated by the indecent action and exposure of the person on the part of this creature, now posing in the limelight of cheap notoriety. We regret exceedingly the necessity of publicity for the child's sake, but feel assured that the exposure of such a fiend will be regarded as a service rendered to the public. We respectfully request that you publish this in a prominent place in your paper, for the interest of my child and family demand it. Going by the paper, and there seems to be nothing else to go by, it is interesting to note that Slocum did not deny the charge, described as a misdemeanor, and which apparently was indecent exposure. On the contrary, he is quoted as saying something quite different, that he did not recall such an incident, and that if it occurred, it must have been during one of his mental lapses. This is the first hint from Slocum himself of trouble with his head. It is possible for such a blow as he received from a heaving line thrown at Newcastle, New South Wales, in 1896, to produce characteristic lapse of memory. The letter of the girl's father did not save the captain from being committed to jail at Mount Holly, the country seat, not charged with a misdemeanour, but charged with a crime, rape. As for bail, it is obvious that Slocum did not have $1,000, nor any way to raise it. A search of the county clerk's office of Burlington County disclosed neither receipt for bail nor record of indictment. Indeed, being all alone, the aging traveller would seem to have been at a disadvantage in obtaining the maximum consideration of the law. True to his penchant for evoking the unusual, Slocum now found himself cached in a quite remarkable jail. The grey stone structure was almost 100 years old. It had been built in 1808 from plans drawn by Robert Mills, the famous early American architect and leader in the Greek Revival. Day after day, Slocum stayed in Mills's ancient building of grime and handsome colonial design, waiting for a grand jury action which finally did not come, which explains how it happened that he was never indicted. Instead, through signing a waiver, his case was heard by a judge without jury, but that did not come about right away. Today in New Jersey, psychiatric examination is mandatory in cases of alleged sex offenders, but in 1906, it is not unlikely that the authorities were embarrassed to know what to do with their distinguished but somewhat unravelled caller. Slocum was penned up 42 days. It was not a longer time than he had spent on several occasions within the confines of the Spray. Author's note, probably not his first experience of jail. See Voyage of the Liberdade, Chapter 6, for his uncandid account of his trial in Brazil 20 years earlier. It had been 43 days continuous sailing from Juan Fernandez to the Marquesas, 42 from Samoa to Australia. But the view from the jail was different. The jail cell did not rock, and the sound of the lapping of water was not heard. Yet none of the basic conditions, low company, coarse fare, tight quarters, discomfort and obloquy, were new to the merchant captain. It is not likely that at age 62, chance and circumstance still had the power to hurt him. If he was in any way displeased with himself, he was not the man to show it. He had his Spartan code to sustain him. He knew that the Spray down in the river, as usual, offered escape. As for patience, which he called the greatest of virtues, he had learned it from sailing. The end of the unscheduled stopover in Slocum's long voyage home came, the Mount Holly paper reported, on Friday afternoon, 6th of July, when Judge Joseph H. Gaskill held another session of court. The charge had by now been changed to committing an indecent assault. The captain's counsel entered a plea of non vult contendere for his client and said that there was no intention to do the child bodily harm. Non vult contendere, literally he will not contend it, is in New Jersey a legal equivalent to a plea of guilty. It is often used, and his word would seem to have been the case here, to effect a face-saving settlement. When accepted by the court, it becomes an implied confession of guilt, but only for the purpose of the particular case. It is an implied confession only and cannot be used against the defendant in any subsequent suit. By this method, Judge Gaskill quietly put the case to rest. In winding up, he was reported as saying, "I am very sorry to be obliged to administer reproof to a man of your experience and years, and I am glad, and no doubt you are too, that in this case there was no attempt made to injure the person of the girl. Upon request of the family, I can deal leniently with you. You must never return to Riverton, either by rail or water. By payment of all costs, you are discharged." The judge did not pronounce Slocum guilty, though that judgment followed by legal inference from the captain's implied confession of guilt. Slocum was the victim of the hazards of sailing alone, and of the still unsatisfied demands of his temperament. The longing for warmth and the need to be noticed seemed to be as urgent as ever. Meanwhile, he was becoming an old man, becoming forgetful about his dress and possibly his actions. The old defences of repression were crumbling, and he was losing control. Quitting the judge and jail in Mount Holly, Slocum next day picked up the voyage exactly where he had left off. Once more he was on his way to deliver the orchids to the president. More delicate than the captain or the captain's reputation, only one flower had survived the interlude. This he proposed to deliver. It was early August when the Spray sailed into Oyster Bay. One of the president's sons, Archibald, came alongside almost at once. I was sailing around with a sailor from the president's yacht, the Sylph, who was named Obie, Archibald Roosevelt recalled, when we saw a decrepit-looking old sloop with the name Spray painted on it. On boarding her, Captain Slocum greeted us. He was a slim, medium-sized man, dressed in black trousers and a white shirt, and he took us around the boat and told us yarns about his trip. When I went home that evening, I told my father of my visit, and he, since he had heard of the voyage, was very much interested and asked me to go out the next day and extend an invitation to the captain to visit Sagamore Hill. This I did, and in due course the captain arrived, where he proceeded to make friends of all of us, particularly my brother Kermit and me. He was fond of Kermit because he and Kermit were great admirers of the poems by Rudyard Kipling. The captain could repeat much of Kipling. I remember that he liked The Rime of the Three Sealers, The Bellboy, The Long Trail, and The Virginity. Thus, in a matter of days, the captain navigated from a Jersey jail to a place by the side of the president, and after that, Archie and Obie sailed to Newport on the Spray, while Roosevelt wrote a friend on the 6th of August. Archie is off for a week's cruise with Captain Joshua Slocum, that man who takes his little boat without any crew but himself all around the world. Concerning the cruise, Archibald Roosevelt said, "The boat was the most incredibly dirty craft I have ever seen. You can imagine how it offended Obie, who had been trained in the US Navy. When we stopped at New Haven, Obie went ashore and returned with a kerosene stove, which he bought with his own money, and jettisoned the filthy old relic that had served the captain I don't know how many years. In mild warm weather, the captain often cooked on deck, and he had a most ingenious contrivance. He took an old-fashioned laundry tub, and in the bottom of which he coiled a piece of heavy anchor chain. On top of the chain, he built a fire of driftwood. As a diet, he was fond of salt fish, and every so often he would make us enormous pancakes, as thick as your foot, he would tell us. The sleeping quarters were in the after cabin, and Obie and I slept on the top of a wooden chest, and the captain had his bunk. In the hold, there was a quantity of miscellaneous equipment, and an enormous number of conch shells. Some of these had not been too carefully cleaned, and there was a fine ripe odour permeating the centre part of the ship. While we were sailing, we would busy ourselves filing the points off the shells, and thereby making foghorns out of them. These the captain would sell to visitors, who came aboard when he was anchored in a port. He also sold his book, and charged, I believe, 10 cents to every visitor. We learned, under his tutelage, to be pretty good salesmen of the shells and the book. Of course, we saw the famous alarm clock, which had to be boiled before it would run. Beyond my comprehension were his sheets of calculations for the lunar observation he would make, single-handedly, a feat, I believe, which is supposed to require 3 people to work out. It is quite common for sailboats to sail on the wind with little or no attention paid to the helm, but the old Spray was, so far as my experience goes, unique in the fact that it would sail off the wind as well as on without it being necessary to mind the helm after the course was set. The meeting with the Roosevelt family, the first of several, ended in a most cheerful fashion. The captain received a complimentary letter. "My dear Captain Slocum, I thank you for your interesting volume, which, you know, I prize. By the way, I entirely sympathise with your feeling of delight in the sheer loneliness and vastness of the ocean. It was just my feeling in the wilderness of the West. Sincerely yours, Theodore Roosevelt." Author's note: an opinion of the Roosevelt-Slocum encounter, based on conviction rather than knowledge, was published in The Roosevelt Family of Sagamore Hill by Herman Hagedorn, New York, 1954, page 245. Lumping Slocum with Robert E. Perry and reckoning without the orchids, Hagedorn wrote, "There were people who were not beckoned to come to Sagamore, but found a compelling excuse. Two such were seafaring men, the one a pursuer of aimless adventure, the other incarnate purpose to the point of fanaticism. Daring was the quality they had in common. The intrepid water tramp, Captain Joshua Slocum, had all his adult life sailed the seven seas in his 40-foot sloop. If Perry sought out Roosevelt, it seems clear that Slocum, in his oblique way, walked in as one of the invited. The intrepid water tramp had not, of course, spent all his adult life in sailing the sloop. To write of Slocum without reference to his 20 years' career as a merchantman, to his unique and lasting achievement, above all, to the fact that he wrote an immortal book, is like describing John Chapman as a backwoods orchardist while neglecting to mention his accomplishments as Johnny Appleseed. After seeing Archie and Obie home, Slocum went home himself, for the first time in 9 months or so. But after less than a month on the farm, he was on his way again, still planning, still searching. The new dream was to be the first man to go through the Panama Canal. After that, he wanted to push on to China and Japan to demonstrate, as he said, that it is an easy trip. But there is no record of the captains having seen the canal, on which preliminary work had begun in 1904. The fact that the canal was not opened until 1915, by which time Slocum, if he had lived, would have been 71. Before embarking on any grandiose scheme, there was still that piece of unfinished business, what to do about the Libertad. The Slocum-Smithsonian correspondence had now been dragging along for 6 years, and the boat was still in Washington, still in the way. Finally, another letter went off, this time from Providence, Rhode Island, on the 13th of October, 1906. "My dear Professor Mason, I feel guilty for not having carted this boat away, and after you have been so kind, I have no right to ask, but if your people can lodge her somewhere for me till next spring, anyhow, she must go from the present place. Very sincerely, Joshua Slocum." Later in the year, Slocum made arrangements to have the Libertad delivered to a boatyard on the Washington waterfront, but just where, or when, or what became of her, no one knows to this day. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.